Coming up today, Google Glass goes on sale in the UK, Amnesty has launched a panic button app for activists, and we reveal the malware governments have been using to snoop on journalists and politicians. We'll also be talking about the online identity companies trying to cash in on pearl-clutching porn panic, as well as Yo, the app that seems to have kicked off startup silly season. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to glass holes and suicide research. I'm your host, Olivia underscore Solon. I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And hello, everybody. So we're gearing up for Wired Money, which is taking place next week. And that marks exactly 1 year since we had dear Katie Collins joining our team.
I'm very excited. It's my 1 year Wired anniversary.
Anniversary? No, that doesn't work.
We're not making any cake.
Oh,
I know.
Really?
We're working hard.
We are
covering Wired Money.
We are talking about dough, though.
Yes.
So Wired Money is the event to go to if you want to talk about or hear about fintech startups, economics, kind of disruptive businesses that are transforming the financial landscape. It's going to be a good one. It's in level 39 in Canary Wharf, which is a sort of fintech incubator.
Mm. With lovely views.
With beautiful lovely views. So even if the content's boring, the view won't be. it's on Tuesday, the 1st of July. So if anyone wants to buy a ticket, just visit wired.co.uk/money14 and you will be able to find all the information there. But there's news to talk about this week. And the first piece of news relates to Google and its ridiculous specs.
That's right. So I'm sure you probably all know what Google Glass is by now, but just in case you don't, they are Google's high-tech specs that it developed in its futuristic laboratory over in Silicon Valley. And these have been out for about a year now, no, perhaps more than a year, to developers and VIPs and that kind of thing, who have been allowed to join Google's Explorer program.
Yeah, and it's not exploring like space or anything. It's just exploring the world through their glasses.
Yes.
Basically app development.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you can use Glass to do a variety of things, make phone calls, take photos, you know, all these kind of...
Be distracted by a little screen in your glasses while you're meant to be talking to friends.
Abuse the privacy of others.
And I tried it out the other day and it actually is really distracting. I couldn't focus on what I was seeing and also on the screen at the same time. Maybe it's just me.
So you could focus neither on the screen nor on the person that was in front of you.
I was just kind of trying to, you know, when you pull focus on a camera, it was like that, just kind of going in and out between the two. But anyway, yeah, so finally these tech specs have come to the UK. The UK is the first country to get them outside of the US. Mm. And to buy them, the only requirements are that you are over 18 and that you have your own credit card.
And £1,000.
Oh, yes, and £1,000. That's quite key. Fortunately, if you can't afford them, Google's holding a little event in London this Friday and Saturday. So if you've listened after the weekend, I'm very sorry. But you can book, there's a link on our website actually on our Google Glass article. You can book to go down and just have a go, spend a little bit of time using Google Glass to see if you like it, which is probably recommended if you are even thinking of investing all that money.
Yes. Yeah, I wonder if they'll let you do it and try them in shops. Where are they selling it?
It's not a product yet. It's still a prototype.
It is still a prototype, but they're only selling it online at the moment.
So you can't go and try it anywhere if you're going to buy it online, apart from Friday and Saturday at King's Cross.
Well, so far. But it's launched,
most of us have already tried wearing them at some point. Like, it's not like, just because it hasn't launched in the UK.
Us here, not the general public.
Oh, right. Yeah, I know. But it's not like they haven't been available to people in the UK before. There were no bans on bringing them over.
Yeah, that's true. And I've seen plenty of people walking around with Google Glass on, still looking a little bit out of place. But
yeah,
I think Google's hoping that will change. I tried on some of their designer frames and they were actually quite nice. There were some There were some good frames there, lots of different colours and shapes, but as a non-glasses wearer...
It's not going to help matters, is it?
Yeah, I can't really see myself putting them on, just, you know, out of choice. Still, anyway, Google's got a variety of launch partners in the UK who've created special apps, and these include The Guardian, StarChart, which is an astronomy app, Zombies Run, and Goal.com.
Zombies Run sounds fun.
Zombies Run does sound fun, although can you imagine running around with £1,000 worth of technology strapped to your face?
Yeah, and being trying to look at the zombies chasing you as opposed to the road ahead of you.
It sounds like a terrible accident waiting to happen, if you ask me. But anyway, I tried out the StarChart app and it was actually really cool. I'm not really, you know, that into Google Glass, but when I tried this, basically what happens is you look wherever you look, even if you're kind of looking down through the earth, you get this whole star chart all around you, so you know exactly where all the constellations are at any one time.
So it's an augmented reality app, but that you view through Google Glass,
and it sort of lays the constellations over. So imagine if you were looking at the stars, you would be able to, you would see the shape of the constellation and also its name.
Which
is actually really cool. I'm not sure how much people would use it, but
that's not, that kind of app isn't unique to having to wear glasses. You can get an iPad app that does something similar that will hold, you can hold up to the, or a, any mobile app that can do something similar, but this is just, you know,
hands-free
so you can really enjoy the star view.
You can lift your arms in the air and just appreciate being in nature.
Yes, well,
or just look at the stars.
That's certainly one to try. What do you think of Google Glass? Obviously, we've been lucky enough to be able to try it out already, but perhaps some of our listeners haven't. Are you interested? Would you be prepared to spend £1,000 on trying them out? Do let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk. So next up, we're going to talk about a slightly more somber topic, Liat, which relates to a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy around suicide warnings.
Yes, this relates to a study that centres on something that happened in the US around 2003 and the years following. And the study basically kind of blames, partially at least, the media and the medical industry for a rise in suicides among teenagers. Now, this study was carried out by a couple of medical centres in Harvard who looked at data of 1.1 million teenagers, 1.4 million young adults, and 5 million adults in the US, round about the time the FDA made an announcement warning about a potential link between antidepressant use among young people and suicides. So, I mean, as you can imagine, like with any medication, they come with an awful lot of side effects warnings. But the FDA announced this after a study came out saying that about 1% of teenagers and young adults on antidepressants think about suicide more often. So it didn't say that they actually committed suicide more often, didn't say there was any correlation between suicide and antidepressant use. They just said these thoughts were more prevalent in 1%, you know, which is quite a minor amount, I guess. But what happened was the news picked up on this. And actually, according to the analysis, which is quite terrifying, antidepressant use dropped among teens and suicide rates rose, which is, you know, obviously not the intended effect of these warnings. It's the absolute opposite, trying to help people.
So how significant was the impact of this announcement?
Pretty darn significant. They said in relative terms, suicide attempts rose by 31% and by 21%, and antidepressant dropped by, their use dropped by about 31%. But they actually think that these are kind of underestimated stats because they only took into account drug overdoses. You know, they didn't want to accidentally have figures of accidental deaths that have been attributed to suicide. Right. So they just focused on drug overdoses.
Surely there are other ways of committing suicide that are obviously not accidental.
I know, like, I don't really want to list them right now, but no. Yes, I agree with you. But
hanging, for example.
Exactly, that's exactly the one I didn't want to give our listeners visual of, but that is exactly the one that jumps to mind.
Yeah. And also, surely, at the same time, drug overdoses might
be accidental. Yeah. That's what I thought as well.
Especially if you're on lots of medication anyway.
But I guess these are not going to be accidental ones. These are going to be, you know, pretty obvious.
Yeah.
I have taken 100
yeah.
whatever pills. So, I mean, because of that, they think, I mean, these types of suicides only account for 38% of all suicides. I think actually hanging is one of the most popular methods. So actually the figures could be way higher. Mm. But this is just a massive warning, really, to everyone that communication of these types of warnings is really crucial. And if you think about how the medical industry kind of communicates these things, they don't do it very well at all. Mm. You know, side effects on the side of antidepressants can sound quite terrifying.
I mean, side effects on the side of anything, you know, they have to cover all bases mm. for liability reasons. But, you know, you read any drug, whether it's aspirin or, you know, ibuprofen, and they, you know, there's risk of death with nearly everything. Yeah,
exactly.
But and dizziness and sickness.
Yeah. Antidepressants actually have risk of suicide listed. So mm. it's, you know, which is kind of horrifying for anyone yeah. who is struggling and wants some help. But yeah, they basically said the main takeaway is physicians need to balance, you know, when they're explaining to their patients, they need to express the risks of taking antidepressants and not taking them. You know, avoiding yeah. them when you're in dire trouble and they might actually help you is not necessarily the greatest solution.
Yeah.
And I think the FDA did actually kind of adjust its warnings from 2007, and they saw a bit of a shift after that. But it's quite worrying, the kind of the power the media has as well, obviously, to deliver these messages. Obviously, there's no way of saying, yes, it's their fault that suicides yeah. rose, but it's quite a stark correlation, I think.
But this was something that Katie mentioned in an article we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, but it wasn't specifically relating to warnings on antidepressants, but it was more about just media reports per se. Mm.
Yeah, no, so there's a tendency when a suicide's reported in the press for there to be a sort of a spate of copycats mm. afterwards, and because for that exact reason, the Samaritans, which is an organisation in the UK, actually issues media guidelines about the best way to report suicides in order to minimise the harm that it might do to other people out there that are struggling.
Mm. And this has repeatedly been the case when the media has reported on mass killings, hasn't it? I'm sure there's been quite a lot of reports saying what not to do, how not to report it.
Don't and always glorify yes. the perpetrator.
Exactly. And, like, without a doubt, it's done time and time again. And
not by us. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about a necklace that acted as a sort of panic button for bad dates. And you could kind of press it in the middle of a terrible conversation and you'd automatically get a call delivered to your phone to sort of rescue you. Well, this week, Amnesty International has launched a panic button for a slightly more serious reason, and which is for human rights activists who are at risk of attack, kidnap, or torture. Now, this is an Android app, and the interesting thing about it is that it can be activated by pressing the power button on the mobile phone. So let me just run through how it works. You download the app, and first of all, it disguises itself as a calculator on your home screen. So it's not kind of a glaring, I have got a activist app on my phone icon. And you have to enter a little code in the calculator's kind of keypad in order to get past the calculatory interface. And then it allows you to enter in three contacts who are kind of trusted people who you would like to help you out in an emergency, whether that's your lawyer or a friend, a fellow activist. And then a message that you can kind of plug in that you would want to send to them in case there is a problem when you go on whatever mission you might be doing. You can then kind of set the app into panic mode, so you don't have to have this on the whole time. And then you just go off and do whatever you're going to do, go to that meeting that you might be a little bit worried about. Then, if something does put you at risk, you just have to press the power button 5 times in quick succession. So you don't need to go into any app. You can do this from the lock screen. And there'll be a little bit of vibration feedback to tell you that the alarm has been sent. And it will secretly send an SMS and your GPS location to those three contacts. Now, Amnesty's given some guidelines about this because obviously you don't want to endanger your contacts. So, and they had to really balance the risk of endangering other people with the risk of, you know, you having some kind of physical harm caused to you. And so they've encouraged individuals not to use any words that are particularly revealing, as kind of maybe kind of code words that you've agreed with your contacts. Because if you are in danger, it's likely your phone's going to get confiscated. They're going to look through it. You know, maybe you run the risk of kind of revealing some trade secrets. Now, Amnesty's been developing this app for a couple of years now. And the reason why they've made it is because the first few hours after someone's either arrested or kidnapped are absolutely critical if you want to mobilise a response. So whether it's kind of arranging a protest or getting the lawyers or police involved, the sooner you do that, the better. And obviously, often people who've been kidnapped, it's not discovered until they're due to meet someone several hours later. But although the app is, you know, useful for these sorts of emergency cases, Amnesty is fully aware that there are lots of regimes, including our own and the America, where mass surveillance is taking place, particularly against activists. And actually, we'll be talking about that in our next story. So if that is the case, this app might not necessarily be the best tool. But Amnesty did say they've spoken to loads of activists and they decided that the risk of having an SMS intercepted was worth it if it meant that they could get the word out if they were in danger.
This also sounds like a much better alternative to that button that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, in terms of if you are in any kind of danger, being able to use a service like that to send your GPS location.
I mean, why need an additional ridiculous necklace? Okay, I know that was a joke one, but the idea of actually accessing the power button as a mechanism for sending an SMS is an interesting one.
Although I guess that is going to be the first thing that anyone, you know, if you do get arrested, it's the first thing they'll do is search you and take your mobile phone from you.
Yeah.
Especially if you're an activist and it's your job to get the word out for anything and everything.
But maybe you could just do it quickly as it was happening.
I hope so.
Before they manage to wrestle it from your grip, presumably.
An app like this won't necessarily help you from any kind of scary regimes if the government is already tapped into your phone. And this seems to be quite an issue, isn't it, Katie?
That's right. So an investigation between two different laboratories, Citizen Lab and Kaspersky Lab, who both kind of look at antivirus kind of software, that's probably where you know the name Kaspersky from, have found out that an Italian company's surveillance software has been used to spy on mobile phones of human rights activists, journalists, politicians, all using remote-controlled implants. What they found out as well is that all four of the major smartphone operating systems are susceptible to this, which is obviously iOS, Android, Windows Phone and BlackBerry.
So just to be clear, this implant, it's a piece of malware, right?
That's right, yeah. So it's the actual malware itself is called Galileo, and it's made by a company called Hacking Team.
Well, that are the clues in the title then, isn't it?
They're awful, actually. If you look at their website, they have these hilarious quotes, which is like, beat encryption, like, you know, the thing that we all are desperate to do, beat encryption.
So basically any government that has the money to purchase this software can do so. There are a few exceptions. So it won't sell the malware to countries such as North Korea, for example, and other countries that have been blacklisted by the EU, the UN, NATO, that kind of thing.
I wonder how on earth it polices that.
Well, exactly. I think they actually have a review system, but they're the ones reviewing it, so they can just say yes to anything.
Sounds a bit like that court in the US that
reviews. Secret court.
Yeah.
It's a secret court by the company itself.
which has a
huge commercial interest.
Selling kind of these tools to some countries but not others.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the rule is, you know, countries with poor human rights records, or, you know, that perhaps the US or UK doesn't have dealings with.
Oh, right. So, but it's okay for the US and UK to spy on its own citizens.
Exactly.
Because otherwise, great. Yeah. You know, in all other ways.
Well, I guess in their naivety, well, not their faux naivety, Hacking Team says this is for, you know, actual policing. Police operations, legitimate police operations.
Okay, so I get that you have to have a piece of malware on your phone, but how do you actually get the malware onto your phone? Like, it's not like activists are just kind of being that stupid as to allow government to install malware while their back's turned.
No, obviously. And in fact, if you were an activist, the likelihood is that you'd be way more careful than the average person anyway. So there's a number of techniques that can be used to infect mobile devices. These include things like social engineering, which is basically the fake links that are spread around social networks, which apparently a surprising number of people still are fooled by even now.
I thought social engineering was just generally like targeting people as the weakest link rather than the technology. So kind of calling up and getting, you know, the individual in the company to give away details rather than...
But that's the same in hacking. Social media, isn't it? That's the human error element where you're just...
Rather than any conniving
something.
Kind of hacking into a phone.
And in fact, you know, a lot of these kind of things do rely on sort of human error. So there are other things like direct USB infections.
Okay.
And if you say you wanted to hijack an iPhone, you'd have to either do it physically, so somebody would have to take the iPhone off you.
Okay.
Or it would have to be connected to a computer. That way the malware could be installed.
So if someone says, oh, do you want to charge your phone on my laptop? Be very wary.
Yeah. Or if they give you a USB stick.
Surely that means that every single tech company at any trade show.
Every media kit.
Potentially targeting journalists.
That would be
Huawei.
Such a clever government ruse.
I don't think I've ever bought my own USB stick.
No.
Every USB stick I've ever owned has been given to me by somebody else.
But that is so foolish. I went to this Kaspersky Lab day and they literally were like, journalists are the biggest targets. Most targets are journalists.
Did they give this to you on a USB stick?
No.
So do we know the scale of this? You know, yes, they've got this technology that can be put onto mobile phones. Are governments definitely using it?
So not definitely. They can kind of guess because they've been monitoring some of the targets. And they tend to be political targets like refugees, activists, and in countries like Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, Ethiopia. And it's been kind of linked with 44 countries around the world that could potentially be using this. But it's being used for more and more different things. So things like industrial espionage, which is something that the US and China have both been accused of in terms of their own surveillance programs already. And I think it's probably way more common than we already know. And also things like governments spying on foreign embassies. But it's also been used by law enforcement increasingly as well. So there was a case in Germany in 2011 where this software was used to spy on a man that was suspected of steroid dealing, for example. And law enforcement agencies usually hate malware and anything to do with it. But when it comes to them using it, they sort of tend to feel a bit differently about it.
I think if there's cause for believing that someone's committing a crime, that's one thing, and getting a warrant and then tapping someone's phone, I'm kind of okay with that. But it's more if people are just being surveilled indiscriminately, and I don't know. I guess with this, you don't necessarily know.
Well, we know we are being surveilled indiscriminately.
Well,
don't we?
It's kind of like, well, we know we're being watched already through mass surveillance. So, does an extra bit of malware make any bloody difference?
Yeah. Well, if the malware, like you say, for targeted purposes with a proper kind of legal structure behind it, then it makes perfect sense. Because I know the guy who was talking about this was saying, you know, people always tap phones, you know, we've been doing it forever, tapping phones. And I think the FBI releases stats on how many phones they've asked to tap in the past year, kind of like Google's transparency report, but for surveillance. And, you know, the flip side of it. But obviously, no one uses their landline anymore. So it makes perfect sense to do it this way. But it depends how you're doing it and whether there's any kind of oversight.
And they actually said that they sort of see it as a middle solution, middle ground between phone tapping and physical searching, which, I mean, I don't really understand, because they'll be looking through your WhatsApp, Viber, Skype conversations, cached web pages, calendars, location services. So the amount of information that you can get from that is just massive. People have such a personal relationship with their phones these days.
Yeah,
I think it's like the lazy and cheap way of doing it. Physical searches.
It's much cheaper than the, because obviously you can just kind of deploy it and then wait for it to do the job on its own. But
so if we don't want to be spied on in this way, just the other way, what do we need to do? Just be very careful about links we are opening. Don't download any apps that you're not 100% sure about.
Yeah.
And keep your password on your phone at all times.
And keep your software updated.
Don't hand your phone over to any government. Officer or...
What if they command you?
Oh, actually, you know what? So I don't want to brag, but I've been to visit number 10 a few times. And when you go in, you have to leave your phone in these little cubby holes. There's like little pigeon holes. You have to leave it there. You're not allowed to take it in. And now I'm thinking that they are tapping my really boring Facebook updates.
That's why journalists are the most targeted group, because we're so stupid.
Oh, and when I went
every time we go to see the government.
When I went to visit the president in Rwanda as well, I wasn't allowed to take my phone in there.
Yeah, so. Instant malware injection.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, well, that's all we have time for with the news this week. But still to come, we're going to be discussing the online identity companies that are trying to cash in on porn panic. And we're going to talk about the fact that it's silly season for startups.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Now, there's something I've missed.
What's that?
I've missed riding, but not just any riding. I've missed riding the Technosaurus.
So guys, let's talk about porn.
Again, Leah, this is your special subject.
Well, I haven't talked about it for a while, so I thought I need a renewal. So for those of you that don't know all the porn regulation stuff that I'm so interested in, first I'll have to give a bit of background. But this all relates to a company that wants to provide age verification services for online pornography so that you don't have to. So we've covered a group called ATVOD quite a bit in the past, the UK's regulatory body for TV on demand. And it has been making noises for quite a few years about how internet pornography sites should have age verification systems. They should be regulated like the online gambling industry, and they should be paying them fees. It argues that the content could seriously impair minors, and thus has to have age verification technology around it, because this is something stipulated by EU law. Now, earlier in the year, this is what kicked off my porn series, they carried out a survey.
It's not that kind of porn series. a series of articles about the issues around regulating porn.
Yes, that is what I meant. That's what I meant. I might have a couple porn series. Now, this survey itself, and it found out that something like 6% of kids have come across adult content. Now, lots of scaremongering ensued. It didn't mention that adult content can actually be an Anne Summers website or just some nudity, not necessarily hardcore porn. But anyway, what has happened now is a Dutch group has come out and said, yes, we have the answer to all your porn problems. Age verification through social media profiles.
So what's the company called?
They are called Veridoo.
Now, I think they do have something quite interesting in terms of the technology, right?
Yes, absolutely. They've been talking, well, I've heard murmurings of this for a while, because basically guys within the porn industry that are already regulated and want regulation, they don't, when they start their online site, to have to drive customers away by saying, oh, we're going to check you on the electoral roll, we're going to credit check you, give us your credit card details. They just know that's going to put people off. So this is going about it in a totally different way, basically using your social media profiles to completely bypass all that faff. Mm. And it basically, it does this by asking you to set up a profile away from the adult content site using your social media logins. And you can use as many as you want, like Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Google+. And the more you provide, the more robust it will be. Then its algorithms basically compare the data across social networks. So on Facebook, if you say you're 40 and you're friends with lots of 40-year-olds, then fine. It will check, you know, cross-check to see if you've got some shared connections across different social networks. And basically, the guys who created it think you can't trick this, you can't make it up. You'd have to put thousands of hours into building fake profiles. So they think it's fairly robust. So on the one hand, it's obviously kind of not forcing you to give up personal details like your credit card. It's not forcing you to be kind of named and shamed. That I'm sure anyone really cares, because it's the site.
Well, you say that, but this company knows what you're doing,
because exactly.
It has to provide the key and you're linked to all of your social networking sites.
Exactly.
I'm not sure most people want their porn habits in some way linked to their social networking sites generally, even if it's through some kind of encrypted key that doesn't count for anything. There is a company that can connect the two.
This is what I find a bit funny about it, because the whole point is it's supposed to be easy, it's supposed to not put you off sharing your personal details from your credit card, but yeah, you're giving them access to mountains of information on you, far more than your credit card company has on you, probably, you know, with all the things you're signing up to. It even wants you to give your PayPal details. So I can't really get my head around why that is going to be more preferable to you. Yes, perhaps it's more easy, but actually the tokens they give you can run out. It basically gives you a token at the end saying you're over 18. But if a provider says wants quite a robust check, they'll make you go through the process again, because Verity only has contact to your social media networks for a brief amount of time.
Okay, so it's not so bad.
Well, it can just suck it all up, Liv, can't it? Stick it on its servers. But it says it doesn't use your information for anything other than checking your name, and shouldn't store the information. But there's actually no legislation around this, so it doesn't actually have to be strict at all. The guys there said they're waiting for government legislation to say how strict it should be, but actually, you know, it could end up being as worthwhile as ticking a box saying you're 18, because it doesn't have to be, you don't have to legally verify yourself at all.
Now, I think one of the interesting things that came through in this story was how closely matched the viewpoint of the verification company, which name I can't remember, Veridoo, and Atford, the regulator, were. It seemed like there might have almost been some kind of, conspiracies too much, but, you know, working together. Well, they're on the same page, aren't they? Both of them could stand to benefit from everyone using this technology.
Absolutely. And I think going forward with this, everyone should be really clear on that, first of all, because Veridoo actually opened with its press release going, 6% of children are watching pornography, according to Atvod. And it plucked out the most scaremongering term from the regulatory body that will make loads of money out of this if it goes through, and led in with that. So, yeah, there is so much crossover. Even when they were talking, they were literally using the same phrases about the gambling industry.
And, of course, Veridoo would make the money from the porn sites who'd pay to use their verification service, right?
Yeah, and it is way cheaper than credit card checks and things like that. Apparently, it's only 10p a check. Okay. Versus £1 to £2. But the thing with this is it's supposed to, a lot of people talk about it like, oh, we're going to help save the adult UK porn industry, because all these evil tube sites around the world are totally unregulated and they're free, so they're taking over. But actually, they're probably the ones with all the money that will bother to pay for this, like Pornhub.
Yeah.
They're huge. Whereas all the kind of independent UK ones will
not have the money.
I sincerely doubt they would survive. So I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, yes, you know, maybe it's not great for kids to just see porn all the time, fine, but I've read quite a bit around this, and educators and academics have repeatedly urge the government to basically invest in education, not banning content, not bringing in regulatory fees, not putting in age verification. They said these things never work, and they actually can sometimes hinder a minor's development, because they're not actually getting the same access to the internet that they might otherwise, with filters everywhere blocking different content. And I find it a bit strange, the department that carries out these investigations, Department for Culture, Media and Sport, totally ignores all of those, and in its conclusions almost verbatim always repeats what Atvod says.
The other thing that I've been wondering about listening to this is, obviously there are calls for legitimate porn sites or kind of companies out there for this kind of technology. But what about all the unregulated sort of not so legitimate porn sites out there? I mean, who's to say where the porn's going to be hosted? And you know, I think it's so it solves part of the problem, but what about all the porn on the internet that is on, you know, Tumblr or
Imgur and stuff?
Well,
like
I genuinely think they'd have to block it or attempt to block it.
No way they'd be able to do it.
No, exactly.
And actually only the compliant companies, the good companies, would be the ones to even have this
to bother. Yeah, I don't understand how it's at all practical, because the only way you can enforce this is just to say, you know, we're going to regulate you, do this and that and pay us a fee or we'll block you. But that's such an empty threat.
But you know what, I can see why the Department of Culture, Media and Sport is just repeating it parrot fashion, because I think it's political suicide to say, yeah, go for it kids, watch porn. And ultimately that's how it will be interpreted, whatever they say in favour of, you know, not having these sorts of restrictions.
That's just crazy though. Shouldn't the optimum result should be kids are going to have access, or they already do have access to so much stuff. The damage is done. Educate them. It's like, well, actually something we're going to talk about in a minute, someone wrote in about this app which stops kids sending selfies or sends it to their parents. Wouldn't it be far better? It's apparently supposed to stop them sexting. Wouldn't it be better if you raised your kid to not want to sext when they're 12.
Or to sext responsibly.
Yeah, or sext responsibly, or sext when they're old enough to understand what sexting is and what it means emotionally.
We'd be really interested to hear what you think about this topic. I mean, perhaps it's sensitive, maybe you want to comment anonymously, but what do you think of the idea of having age verification for porn sites? Do you think it's okay? Do you think it's going to be too annoying? Do you think it's impossible to implement? Do let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk. The final segment this week is going to be a What the Actual Flip. What the? Yo.
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 It is silly season for startups, and Yo would be first on my list. You may or may not have heard of this. This is an app, a mobile messaging app that only lets you send one message, and that message is, surprise, surprise, Yo.
You can't even follow up.
You can, but with Yo.
Oh my gosh.
It's like Yo.
But
yo.
Like when I say Yo to you, Liv, I put a lot of feeling in. Maybe I'll do an accent. This doesn't give any of that.
There's no Yo nuance in this app. But yeah, it's essentially what would happen if Facebook's short-lived app for poking hadn't died in May. And you might be thinking, okay, this is a ridiculous gimmick. We've seen loads of stupid apps like this. But it just raised $1 million in funding. This is an app that only sends one message. This is ludicrous, in my opinion.
I don't agree with this.
Crazy. I've been away for the last week and a half, and I came back and everyone was yo-ing each other.
Yeah.
And
really?
And I tried to yo some people, but unfortunately only one of my friends is on Yo, so I just yo'd him.
So how do you know that everyone was yo-ing again. Each other?
Everyone's just talking about
just like
it.
Just like people on the street are just like, yo.
Well, that's the interesting thing. So yeah, raised $1 million and now it's been experiencing some horrible security issues.
Surprise, surprise.
So there are some students at Georgia Tech who claim to have hacked it within the first kind of week or so of it becoming popular. And the hack that they said they'd done allowed them to see any Yo user's mobile phone number. And the way that they proved this was the kind of classic technique of calling up the founder of Yo and saying, hey guys, hey dude, we found a vulnerability. Yo, sorry. Yeah, of course not. Yo, we found a vulnerability in your app. And Yo's actually since hired one of those hackers.
Why on earth is security always the last thing? It's the same with all kind of startups and apps.
Well, you know what? I think he might have just started this as a joke and then it kind of snowballed and now it's kind of a thing bigger
or
than...
Or yo-yoed.
It's yo-yoed.
Now, that would mean it was like... Out of favour.
But there was another hack that someone claims to do. They created a Vine, and the Vine seemed to show that they'd hacked the Yo notification sound that is just like a yo as you get the message. And they've hacked it to play a segment of Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up, the old Rick rolling. That joke's never gonna get tired. And in my mind, I was thinking, okay, this is a bit like Crazy Frog, you know, that really annoying ringtone that was huge. It made some money, but ultimately it was pretty pointless and meaningless. But just as I was getting used to that fact, we had another one come in from sideways, and it was Washboard. This is a business in the US that sends you coins in the post so you can do your laundry. So this is for super lazy people. It will send you $20 worth of quarters for $26.99.
What?
So you pay a 35% markup on money.
This hurts my face. Like, no one would do this.
Well, that's, maybe we just don't understand, because over here we don't really use laundrettes. Most of us have washing machines.
That's a huge
home.
Markup. That's ridiculous. You're paying $6.
Oh yeah, it's also ridiculous. And what's wrong with just going to a shop and getting change?
Yes, that's what I said. If I ever need change, go to the corner shop. They are nice people.
But yeah, we thought it'd be an opportunity to think about some of the most ridiculous apps and startups that we've come across lately.
Well, there was the spate of kind of, you know, misogynistic apps, which I think we kind of bit the bait and gave them publicity. Bro app. And carrot dating, do you remember?
Wait, yeah,
was
that last remind year? Me, Bro App.
So Bro App was basically, I believe it was, so that you don't have to text your girlfriend, you can send pre-programmed automated messages to her throughout the day so that she feels loved. Don't ask me what happens when she actually replies and says, why are you talking like an American? Because it's an American app.
Yeah, bro. I remember this one because the guy who made it, you spoke to, and I remember him saying something like, guys are generally just busier than girls.
Yes.
So girls, you know, guys don't have time to write text messages, where girls just sitting around waiting to text their
It was
lovers.
Essentially that women are really needy, cliche of the week. Women are needy, men are busy, they have busy and important jobs and busy and important lives.
And we were trolled effectively on that one.
Yeah, we kind of were trolled. I sucked
the whole
it
world,
up.
The whole world was trolled.
I'm just keen for the startup trend to call your company or app a name ending with Lee to end. Just
okay.
Anything ending. I think there's been a real trend. So I think, you know, Bitly, Spokely, Seekly, Scopely, Singly, Findly, Hurdly, Quickly.
When in doubt,
there
yeah,
are all
Bitly.
These sort of, and you know, I prefer a company's name to sort of just give me an idea of what it does rather yeah. than all these kind of made up words.
But isn't it because they run out of the actual words? I mean, now you've got the new generic top level domains, you can fill your boots, but they run out of all the kind of basic descriptive nouns and adjectives that you could use, and so you have to just start removing letters and adding Lees and
real
dot
words
IOs.
So real words are so 20th century.
Mm.
Like it's not an exciting a startup if it's not got an unusual non-name
with Lee on the end.
With Lee, that's what my family, no, my brother calls me sometimes. Lee, Lily.
There's your startup,
Lily.
Lily.
XXX. XOXOXX.
Oh wow. Okay, we're seriously gonna have to check that website out. But there was also the whole carrot dating phenomenon.
Yeah, and I think this guy might have actually taken it quite seriously. It was, you basically bribed for dates, didn't you? So Liv got a few messages like offering her
plastic surgery.
Well, I was gonna say cinema ticket. Plastic surgery is a lot of money.
Yeah.
I would take that.
Yeah, so it was a dating app that said bribe your way to a date, and it was targeted at men, and all the marketing seemed to be around like men attracting women using actual carrots dangling from sticks. And actually, the interesting thing about that one is I spoke to the guy who made it, called Brandon Wade, I think his name is, and he knew exactly what he was doing. He was creating a ridiculous app for the marketing punch that it offered. And he said the free advertising he gets from having this controversial business model for a dating app, which are essentially so undifferentiated, you know, between all the different dating apps, they all do the same thing. So if you can get something that gets you into the headlines, you'll get the downloads. And I think he had something like 90,000 downloads in the space of a few weeks as a result of being so controversial in his approach. But I would be very interested to hear what you think are the silliest apps and startups that you have seen over the last few months, perhaps ones that are about to launch. Do let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk. So we've done the news and the discussion for this week, but we're about to move into the feedback loop. Now, this is where we talk about all of the different emails and tweets and Facebook messages we've received about previous episodes of the podcast.
So Adam Coleman wrote in about school surveillance. We talked about this on the podcast last week, how there is a troubling amount of new technology being used to spy on your kids. He says, hello, Wired UK podcast. I just finished your most recent podcast and was left completely gobsmacked by the school surveillance revelations. As you highlighted, the surveillance and biometrics are, to put it very softly, intrusive and disproportionate when compared to their goal of students and staff safety. It also bamboozles me that the Department for Education and the schools themselves would rather fund this than the needed equipment, teacher training or extracurricular activities. It would seem, with my conspiracy hat on, that the lobbyists and their sacks of money have won again. I just hope that in the future, any money spent is proportional to the problem it wishes to solve. In most, but definitely not all scenarios, this ideology would produce the best results and could perhaps be implemented more strongly by the government.
Yeah.
Agreed.
We had quite a few comments actually on this topic. We had Shane Diffley writing in, and he said that he's actually developed an app that chips away at kids' privacy. He admitted it. He said it's called Selfie Cop. It's what Liat mentioned earlier. And it automatically emails selfies sent by teens to their parents.
No.
Awkward.
Awful.
So the aim was to deter sexting among teens. But the interesting thing is he sent a very long email, and we are going to have a story about this on the website soon. But he said he really considered carefully the privacy versus kind of security aspect of this. So the app works by sending parents a secure copy of every photo or video taken on their child's smartphone. And the idea is to make kids stop and think every time they're about to take a snap. Do I really want my mum and dad to see me like this? Is the question they want the kids to ask. And so, he said he went through a lot of debate about privacy versus risk and concluded that he had a dilemma, which was balancing his increasing empathy with kids versus the need to sometimes save them from themselves.
Every photo, man, if only they could use some kind of recognition for naughty parts.
Yeah.
And only send those.
Oh.
That would be awful and haunting for parents.
Just so the kids know, like if you sexed, we'll know about it.
But hang on, I would say this is aimed at 9-year-olds to 13-year-olds. So perhaps this is an age group where people feel slightly more comfortable about a bit more oversight. But still, it's an odd alternative to actually talking to your kids.
Daniel Adele has also written in about this. He says he's been listening to our podcast for 2 months, but this is the first time he's commented. He said that when he first heard about the surveillance, he was angry, but then he remembered two unfortunate truths. Truth number one, schools in London are not a safe place anymore since all the violence and poverty spills into where kids and teens socialise most, the school. Also, university and secondary schools are easy places to sell things, from food to drugs. I'm not going to lie, if there was more security at my school, a lot of craziness would have been put down. So, truth number two, the cost of running a school has only risen during the recession, so it makes sense to find ways to cut costs, like having fingerprint tech to keep track of expensive books and help teachers increase their effectiveness. Of course, this only works if teachers use surveillance to make schools safer and management collaborate with teachers to make full use of data to make the schools better. And no, I'm not smoking what they're selling.
Well, he's kind of right. If it's being used for its true purposes and with proper security in place, then...
But the concern that we had was that it wasn't. It was kind of leaking into a widespread surveillance of performance of students in schools.
Absolutely. Don't do that. Jack Bird also wrote in about this. He said, for those students worried about cameras in classrooms and being watched, we found an effective method was to just not engage in the lesson for fear of being watched. The school soon got the message and took the cameras out. Although we had fingerprint scanners that we would use to pay for lunch, these worked more efficiently than finding the correct money. And I felt like the school could have made better use of the technology by allowing electronic sign-in or possibly taking out library books. Seeing as schools have massive data on students, I don't view this as a problem, as there isn't much they can do with the fingerprint, or so we think. I do feel, however, as though a school just needs to say to protect against bullying, and they can justify anything they want to.
Absolutely right.
Mm.
So regular listener Roy Mather wrote in and he'd done a quick analysis of the podcast that he subscribes to. He said of the podcast he subscribes to, the total number of lead presenters is 39. And he was looking at the diversity of these lead presenters. He said when it comes to ethnicity, there's only one Asian presenter and one that he counts as other. That is actually him. And that's for his own podcast, which is called Roy's Rocket Radio, if anyone's interested. Gender-wise, he says that only two of the lead presenters are female, and he counts the Wired.co.uk podcast as one of them. So I guess that's me from the last couple of weeks while I've been filling in for Nate. And he added, most of these podcasts have at least two or more presenters, which makes the imbalance even worse. Please consider an all-female podcast. Well, Roy, we have delivered. We've actually delivered for the last, six, 7 weeks.
Yeah, we're doing our bit to fix the balance of this awful misogynistic world.
We have been occasionally having appearances from Chris Higgins, who's our online assistant, but generally it's been a lady fest.
It has.
Long may it continue. No, not long may it continue. We really want Nate to come back, and he should be back soon. And that's all we have time for. So I'm going to say goodbye and see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.